Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Spring is officially next week, but there are plenty of signs of spring right now.
Yes. Yes, abundant signs of spring, and we need them. We desperately need them. And, you know, there's the obvious thing. You drive around now and the crocuses are up and, you know, you see the snowdrops and they've been poking through. And even chipmunks, they always tell us they're not really hibernators, but they mostly do. And they don't get active again until around now. And I've been seeing them for, I don't know, a week and a half or something like that. There's this one I see on my morning walk that seems to just live in this metal pipe, this aluminum, you know, like chain link fence pole that's lying down on the ground in the corner of somebody's yard. And I always see it poking its little face out in the morning. Like, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
Yeah. They're adorable, but I don't necessarily look forward to them coming back because they can subvert the system in my squirrel proof feeders because they don't weigh enough. Mm. I guess I have to look into adjusting the tensioner or something like that. They don't weigh much more than a bird, right. So they can get on there and they don't close down the feeding ports. And certainly in the bird world, there's this progression of very early, you know, really winter events that happen that portend spring. And it starts with blackbirds. Red-winged blackbirds don't go very far. They're a short distance migrant. And so, you know, there are big flocks of them. And a lot of them do winter in various places in Massachusetts and parts of the Cape. And so it's not that surprising when you're seeing them in February and they start singing, but it's the singing that is such a nice sign of spring.
I love
right?
the sound. Yeah.
And there are more of them and they're in appropriate breeding habitat. So the way their breeding system works is it's very important for males to get high quality breeding territories because, you know, they'll have a kind of a harem of females if they have a good breeding territory. And so the males will winter further north and they get very excited very early to try. So they're like thinking about territories in February when it's like months from when they'll actually be breeding. And then grackles are less likely to winter around here. So that's a little more of a clear sign of eventual spring. It's not exactly the bluebird of happiness. You get grackles, and then the other sign of spring in February you get is turkey vultures.
Right.
It's like the grim harbinger of death of happiness. But they come trickling back. So all these short distance migrants start trickling back and providing this little glimpse that, you know, spring is eventually coming.
And you didn't mention robins, and people get very confused about, do the robins stay? Do they go? What's happening? I see robins in winter, but now I'm seeing more robins.
Yeah, it's a perennial point of confusion for people. I just think the average person just doesn't notice that there are thousands of robins around all winter for whatever reason. Something about their behavior, it doesn't click that they're seeing robins. These big flocks flying around eating cedar fruits and holly berries. You know, people, when they look out their front window and they get a good look at the robins eating their hollies, like those people know that robins are around all winter. But if you don't have that experience and you're not really noticing birds as you're driving around, you don't think that there are robins in the winter. And then this time of year, you see them, they're on the ground again.
Yep.
So after a winter of being in the trees, eating fruit, going from place to place, they're sort of itinerant. They are back. It's the season of mud. The worms are kind of struggling with the saturated ground and they're fair game for all these robins. So you see them again. People notice them again in their normal kind of robin-y place hopping around on the ground. And this morning, but of course they've been here all winter. And this morning I heard my first robin singing.
Oh.
That I can think of this year, anyway. You know, bird song starts increasing in January, but I don't feel like I've heard a robin singing until today. Sometimes they'll sing in winter. But it felt eventful when I heard the one that's singing this morning.
Well, we've had quite a few robins hopping around in our backyard, and Jackson and I were watching them out the window, and he was giving me another lesson about robins, saying, see how they're turning their heads? They can hear the worms in the ground.
Yeah. Good for him.
And he still thinks the robin's the most beautiful bird. Yeah.
Yeah, he stuck with that. Good for
Yeah.
him because, you know, little kids phase through things and they forget what their favorite thing was last week or what, but
Yeah. He still
he's
loves
really stuck
Robins.
to it.
Yeah,
He's a
absolutely.
loyal Robin supporter.
Yeah, so 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, stories, or we'll talk about other spring critters if you like. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We've had a couple of really windy days and made me wonder, have we seen anything unusual blowing in with these winds?
Not really.
No.
Yeah, I mean,
Direction,
it's
right?
a lit,
Yeah.
it's a, yeah. So we're getting to the time of year where a strong southerly wind will bring something back early, you know, because migration has started in the deep south and into Central and South America. The birds that are eventually going to come back north, the songbirds, they're stirring, you know, they're starting movements in some cases. And you know, the ones that are in April migrating into Florida and into the southeastern US will get southern winds that will bring them back north way early. And so that's something to look out for next month. It can happen in March. I think there are March records of things like swallow-tailed kite. So yeah, I mean, it could happen, but there hasn't been anything on these winds. I can't even remember the directions of these winds, but I don't think they've been particularly warm
Right. Yeah.
or southerly, but that is something to look out for ahead of May. Like people think of May as that's when the birds come back, but a lot of things do happen in April. There's a lot of migration in April, and it is very wind dependent. Somebody did have a painted bunny that it would probably wintered locally that turned up at a feeder in, trying to remember, Yarmouth or something like that. Just
Yeah.
it's very, very late in the year for a painted bunny that we didn't know about already to just show up at somebody's feeder.
Yeah.
So I don't know where that one came from, but again, I suspect it was wintering locally and just doing okay with natural food sources like most of the birds
Yeah.
seem to be this winter.
It's been a pretty mild winter when you think about it, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right, so, but we do have some late winter rarities, right? Townsend solitaire, Bohemian waxwing.
Right. Yeah, that painted bunny was one, but it seemed to be a one and done, but there have been some ones that have hung on and been putting on a good show for birders who can find them repeatedly, which is always nice. And so this Townsend solitaire, it's one of my favorite birds. Not that I think about them that much, but when they show up, I'm like, hey, that's one of my favorite birds, like so many species.
Depends on the day what your favorite bird is, right?
Exactly. I can't, I'm not like Jackson. I cannot be a loyal supporter of just one species. I'm just all over the map. But solitaires in general, it's a group of birds that most of them are further south. They tend to be birds of the mountains all through Central and South America. There are all these different types of solitaires. They're in the thrush family, and they have gorgeous songs. Just absolutely gorgeous. You're in some mountains in, you know, Mexico or Peru or whatever, and there's some species of solitaire that just sings these gorgeous, ringing, high-pitched songs. And the Townsend solitaire is in the Rocky Mountains, the high Rocky Mountains in breeding season. And then most of them migrate just downhill. They don't, you know, they don't go to South America or Mexico. They just kind of like elevationally migrate down slope to juniper valleys with junipers in them, and they just eat the juniper fruits all winter. But there are some northern populations that do actually migrate kind of latitudinally, and those are probably the ones that sometimes fly the wrong way. And there are a bunch in the upper Midwest where they're not supposed to be, and then we finally got one. I've been expecting a Townsend solitaire all winter, especially because we had such a good crop of cedar fruits. It's juniper. It's what we call cedar is a juniper. Juniperus virginiana is eastern red cedar. And so we've got, you know, great conditions for them. We already had a lot of western tanagers who've also been eating the cedar berries. And one finally did turn up that was probably there all winter up at High Head in North Truro. It's a famous place for rare birds.
Yeah.
You know, you have that sort of cliff up top, and then the wetlands below of various kinds, shrub swamp, and the big, all the wetlands around what used to be Pilgrim Lake, now East Harbor. And so that's all, and there's lots of fruit up there. So that's always been a good spot for rarities, and that's turned up. And if you didn't look closely, you might pass it off as a mockingbird or something. It's like a gray bird sitting on top of a cedar, and you just, oh, yeah, a mockingbird. But they have these buffy flashes in the wings and a shorter tail and an eye ring. They are distinctive if you get a good look at them.
Yeah, and if you hear them sing, then you're really golden, right?
Yeah, they probably wouldn't sing around here. Never say never. And I don't know if it's been calling either. I haven't been up to see it. I need to get up there. But they have a really cool call that I think I described it as walking a bicycle with a squeaky wheel. It's this like high pitched, like there's no way I can imitate it. But it's this high pitched, repetitive, not very bird-like sound that they make. Mm. I think these two hummingbirds are still there that have been in Orleans all winter. Oh. I need to check in on that. But they survived all of the cold spells. There really haven't been cold spells since the last time I heard they were still there. And so I would expect them to hang in until April. These two rufous hummingbirds that they couldn't survive without, you know, supplemental food, but it still demonstrates how tough they are.
Yeah, they're a tough little
and
guys.
Then,
let me ask about the hummingbird for a second, though. When should people put out their hummingbird feeders? I mean, I imagine maybe somebody's had them out for these two rufous hummingbirds. I don't know. Yeah. But when should everybody else start thinking about that?
Yeah. No, like I said, they can't survive without supplemental feeding. And there's a house that has a heated hummingbird feeder that is keeping those hummingbirds alive. But they're getting insects, and people have seen them over in Town Cove. I mean, they're out kind of doing their thing, but those cold spells, they definitely couldn't survive without that hummingbird feeder. So yeah, it's like a year round thing here on the Cape. And hummingbirds winter really far north on the West Coast pretty routinely. There are hummingbird records in like coastal Alaska in winter. Like Anna's hummingbirds winter even further north than these rufous hummingbirds that we get. So it's not as weird as you might think. It's just that they shouldn't be here. We're nowhere near the range of a rufous hummingbird. But they can winter this far north. But in terms of the typical arrival of our hummingbirds, that's like a month from now, you'd be thinking about it, trying to remember where you put your hummingbird feeder, dusting it off, rinsing it off.
Well, I'm impressed that somebody has a heated hummingbird feeder. I didn't even know they had such a thing.
I haven't had a close look at it, but there's clearly a wire going to it. Mm-hmm. And other people have done different things in the past because it's been such a thing that people end up with a rare hummingbird and they have to figure out, you know, it's like you have a pet. You're like, all right, I got to get my neighbor to change out the hummingbird feeder on the freezing cold mornings because we're going on vacation. And so I don't know if I've been meaning to look into it, if this is something you can buy, a heated hummingbird feeder, which is like a weird thing. Why would you need that?
Right.
But they did. And there is a wire going to it. Yeah. And that's why those hummingbirds are alive.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to do the waxwing, but that was sort of the next in line of the interesting rare birds. But
go
we
ahead
can
and
do that one.
Go ahead and do the waxwing. Then we'll do a break.
Do the waxwing. The Bohemian waxwing. What a great species. Another frugivore, another bird that's eating cedar fruits and other things. It's definitely been the winter of frugivorous birds that eat fruit either totally or primarily, at least in the winter. And so this Bohemian waxwing is like a bigger, kind of more beautiful version of a cedar waxwing. People know cedar waxwings. They come around usually in flocks eating, you know, crab apples and cedars, like just like robins. They're beautiful, sort of beigey and yellowy with that wispy crest. And when you get it, you know, it's sort of brownish, but when you get a good look at it, it really is a stunning bird. And they have these waxy, they're unique. They have these waxy tips on the feathers that apparently have an important role in determining their breeding status, their attractiveness. And, you know, the reds and the yellows on the tips of their feathers are carotenoids. They're from fruits that they eat. So they get that directly from food and it gets deposited in their feathers. So Bohemian waxwing is much less common, much further north, more of a boreal species that it's part of this group of birds from the northern forest that don't migrate on a regular schedule. They track food sources, and so they're totally unpredictable. You can make some guesses. There's the Winter Finch Report every year that makes guesses about what birds we'll see down here during the winter from that group of birds, crossbills, and these seed and fruit eating birds from further north. And they like to eat something called mountain ash, which has these little orangey fruits. And the crops of mountain ash sort of determine whether you see Bohemian waxwings or not. And it hasn't really been a winter for them. You know, most winters you might get one or two. This one in particular that has turned up in Yarmouth Port is unusual because it's just hanging around in the same neighborhood over and over again. Usually they just move around. These big flocks of fruit-eating birds just you know, cover a lot of ground. And especially now, things are pretty picked over. And I went and I cased the neighborhood a couple of times. I haven't seen it. It spends hours somewhere else. You know, it's with a flock of cedar waxwings. But birders have been very excited, and a lot of them have been finding it and photographing it. And from looking at the pictures, it seems like it's a lot of what it's eating is privet, which is an invasive. They still sell it. I don't know why the nurseries are still allowed to sell it, because it's sort of an invasive thing. They call it California privet. It's an Asian species that they call California privet for some marketing reasons, I guess. But it's out there in the environment because it's such a common hedge plant still. And at this time of year, birds will eat it. You know, just like all the other invasives, it's invasive in part because the birds will eat it and spread it. So they're eating that. Most of the crab apples are pretty picked over at this point, but they're going on to some crab apples and eating the dregs. They have to be careful because sometimes this late in the season, the crab apples will ferment and the fruit eating birds get drunk. So, yeah, keep an eye out for a drunk waxwing.
Yeah,
it happens.
866-999-4626 is our number. It's Bird News This Morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 for your bird comments, questions, or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joe in West Harwich says, good morning. I feel a little silly asking this question, but I'm genuinely curious. Does Mark know how Buzzards Bay got its name?
No, I don't think anybody does.
I looked it up. Buzzards Bay was first named Gosnold's Hope by Captain Bartholomew Gosnold. The modern name was presumably given by colonists who saw a large bird that they called a buzzard near its shore. The bird was actually an osprey. I don't know how they know that, but that's what I found online.
They don't know that. But that's the common speculation. I mean, obviously, they don't know that. But the bird that Europeans call buzzards are red-tailed hawks. What we call the Buteos, like red-tailed hawk, red-shouldered hawk, rough-legged hawk. In Europe, it's rough-legged buzzard, common buzzard, long-legged buzzard. So, but I don't know if that was the case during the colonial times. Yeah. And people didn't know any big bird. People called turkey vultures buzzards. Yeah. You know,
so it's a guess.
Turkey vultures probably wouldn't have been that far north back then. But anyway, the guess I've always heard is all the ospreys, because I'm sure there were tons.
And speaking of ospreys, any day now, right? We should be hearing about them arriving.
Yes. Somebody casually mentioned seeing one in Falmouth. You never know, but I don't doubt it. I'm sure there's one around somewhere. We're only like less than a week away from the classic first arrival time. And often the first ones are there on the Upper Cape, Falmouth, Bourne, that area where there are so many breeding ospreys. I don't know, close to 150 nests just in Falmouth, I think.
It's crazy.
Maybe more, I'm trying to remember. But it's certainly possible. You know, in February, somebody says, I saw an osprey. Maybe it's a great black-backed gull was sitting on an osprey nest pole, as they do sometimes, or a red-tailed hawk, or increasingly bald eagles. Bald eagles are trying to take over osprey nests more and more, like the one at Oyster Pond right now in Falmouth, where there's a still fairly young, I think maybe 5-year-old pair of eagles, which is young. That would be first time nesters that are trying to take over an osprey nest there. So that's, as I always say, something to be on the lookout for more and more. But yes, be on the lookout for that first osprey. It seems like the Cedar Pond nest out by the Orleans Rotary there on Route 6 has had an early one in recent years. I don't know if that male remembers having to fight off the eagle last year.
Yeah.
That's where that happened. It had to fight off a pair of eagles by himself because the males arrived back before the females. And you wonder what's going on in that little brain as he's coming back from, Brazil or Guyana or something like that. He's like, gotta get back, gotta get back, gotta fight the eagle.
Yeah.
Gotta check on my
Get
nest.
out of my
Yeah.
nest. Yeah. But we have had reports, what, in New York and Connecticut of ospreys arriving already, so they're
Yep.
close, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And same thing for piping plovers.
Yeah. And, the lines are blurred. The mild winters, the bird, these are birds whose populations have skyrocketed in the last decades when you're talking about piping plovers and ospreys. So there are just more of them, which also increases the chances that one might turn up during the winter locally. But also the winters are milder. And so the last few winters, a couple anyway, piping plovers have turned up here and there in the winter, particularly at Seagull Beach in Yarmouth for some reason. So it's like the first plover, did it winter locally or is it really? But yeah, same thing around mid-March. St. Patrick's Day is sort of when you might expect the first ospreys and piping plovers normally. And piping plovers have been seen in Connecticut and New York so far.
Yeah. And
So they're coming.
yeah, you mentioned the bald eagles, and I've been seeing a lot of folks mentioning seeing them, on Facebook posts and thing. And somebody put some really pretty pictures of a juvenile eagle that I guess they saw in Tietik, and I forgot where he photographed it. It wasn't in Tietik, but somewhere in that general area. So we're seeing a lot more of them, right? A lot more of the bald eagles, and it's not as unusual to see them now.
Yeah, right. It's getting to be commonplace. They're not just more of them wintering here, as was the trend for years, but they're breeding here now too. And so they're here year round. It used to be, 20, 30 years ago, June would be a time to see young bald. Yeah, you'd see them in the winter, around the big ponds and things. Not that many, but then in June, a bald eagle would turn up somewhere, a young one. That probably hatched from a nest in Florida a long time ago, fledged a long time ago in the middle of winter, and is now ex exploring its world and came north. So that used to be a common way, but now they're just around. There's bald eagles in every town, just about year round now. And I expect the number of nests to keep going up slowly, but surely.
866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, you have a question, a comment, or a story for us. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So give us an update on the avian influenza. What's happening there?
Yeah, it's been around. I think this is the third year since it was identified in some geese in Wellfleet. So it's probably been like 2 actual years. This is the third, going into the third year. There's something about February. It just seems to spike in around now. I'm not sure why. Birds are just in weakened condition after, getting towards the end of the winter. But it doesn't affect songbirds as far as we know. It's not a thing where you need to take down your feeders or anything. It's waterfowl, raptors, shorebirds. So bald eagles are affected by it. Hawks, sea ducks, shorebirds, gulls. So a lot of what we see around here is gulls and sea ducks, which are the most abundant birds, big obvious birds in the winter. So there have been some little die-offs of, I say die-offs, I'm talking about like five scoters on a beach that makes me wonder if that was HPAI, highly pathogenic avian influenza. So just to distinguish it from what used to be the run-of-the-mill bird flu that was just endemic in bird populations and didn't really make them sick, this is a version that came out of like Asian poultry farms, where you will wild birds and, you know, these viruses bounce back and forth between wild birds and domestic birds and mutate and become more virulent. And so this is a strain that now does kill wild birds, which is very concerning. It's gotten into penguins recently. Oh. The only place it's never been found is Australia so far.
Wow.
But birds migrate around and you know, they'll mix with poultry, and then someone has to kill a million chickens. The word they use is depopulate.
Ooh.
It's funny, all the researchers and the agriculture people say that flock was depopulated, which is a fun euphemism for, you know, having to kill them all. But it's serious stuff. And I just saw an article where they're now using lasers to keep wild birds. Someone was selling a laser technology to keep wild birds out of chicken farms, to keep them from bringing in avian influenza. So
yeah, crazy.
It's getting to be high tech, but I worry about, I mean, think of the tern colony on Monomoy.
Oh, wow.
It's tens of thousands of birds shoulder to shoulder, you know, they're not wearing masks. Mm. And it's gotten into other tern colonies around the world, gannet colonies, big gannet colonies in the north. Some of them have been able to rebound a little bit, but it can be devastating in the short term. And it's just hard to know, you know, long term what will happen. Will they adapt? Will they get immunity and be able to, you know, it'll just be another thing, you know, like COVID. It starts off devastating, and then it becomes another seasonal affliction that is manageable for the populations. You know, time will tell. But I am concerned about local colonial water birds, especially because that tern colony on Monomoy is of like hemispheric importance.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the biggest tern colonies, if not the biggest one on the East Coast.
Yeah. Oh, geez, let's hope not. All right. Andrew writes, just tuning in, so sorry if you've already covered bluebirds. I grew up in New Brunswick in Canada, and I now live in Falmouth, all good Eastern bluebird territory, but I'd never seen one before until yesterday. We were very excited to see a flock of 6 Eastern bluebirds turn up at our garden feeder in Falmouth early yesterday morning. They didn't turn up again today. Was this just a fluke, or will they likely be regular visitors? They were such a brilliant blue, really beautiful bird.
Yeah. Oh, nice to see your first ones. Congratulations. That's where the bluebird of happiness is. Much better than the vulture of death. But yes, bluebirds love the Cape. They're here year round. They breed here. Then, you know, they get into little flocks in winter. I haven't seen them visit my feeders very much because of the mild winter. There's a suet feeder elsewhere in the neighborhood. I've seen them more regularly than at mine, and they're around. But I don't know if they'll be back. Maybe not. Like I said, the pattern has not been they settle in and come every day to the feeders from what I've seen, because they're doing okay out there. And especially as we're getting into closer to their breeding season. They breed fairly early. They're already checking out nest boxes. You know, they'll have eggs in April. And so, you know, they're probably able to find insects already not necessarily needing to come to your feeder again. But I hope they do.
Yeah. Sometimes I see them in T-Ticket Park. So maybe take a walk through T-Ticket Park.
Oh, yeah.
You might get lucky, right? All right. Yes. Bob is giving us a call from Edgartown. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing, Mindy?
Great.
My name is Bob. I work at the airport on the vineyard in the control tower.
Ooh.
So I'm watching birds all the time, and I have a couple things to say. First of all, the turkey vultures are here all year round. Also, I have a family of merlins that nest really close to the tower, and I see them all year round. But I was curious why I'm seeing so many more blue jays this year, and they're much more aggressive than they have been in the past.
First of all, Merlin, yeah. You're right. That's nice to have a Merlin close by, huh?
Yeah, he lives in they nest in a tree really, really close to me. I see him all the time.
Wow.
And where exactly is this again?
At the airport.
On the airport in the vineyard.
Okay. Merlin, if I can remember to take all the different parts of this, but yeah, Merlin is really good. And I'm trying to remember if I knew about them nesting on the vineyard. They nest on Nantucket, nesting somewhere in Falmouth and Western Mass. That's a very new thing. 10 years. I think, that merlins have been nesting at all in Massachusetts. That most birds have been expanding their range north. Merlins are expanding their range south. You know, most merlins breed north of here in the coniferous belt. So that's a very cool bird. And yes, the islands tend to have turkey vultures, especially the vineyard, have turkey vultures year round. Down south where you are, it's like a different climate down there. And I've seen pictures of like big, like good numbers of turkey vultures sitting on roofs on the vineyard. And then
the blue jays are
angry. blue jay populations in the winter are determined by the acorn crop, and so if there's a good acorn crop, was there a good acorn crop on the vineyard? There must
I
have
believe
been.
So. I've seen so many more this year, not only on the vineyard, but I have a house in Rhode Island in Warwick, on near the water near Narragansett Bay, and the numbers are so much greater, and they're so much more aggressive, and they're so, you know, you can see them pretty easy. They're pretty vocal.
Yes. Yeah, it's hard to miss blue jays, right? They're vocal year-round. Even in migration, most songbirds migrate at night, but they migrate during the day in big flocks, so you can actually see their migration happening. But if there are no acorns, they keep going, and there have been winters where there are almost no acorns and almost no blue jays as a result. So it seems to be a pretty clear linear relationship there between acorns and blue jays. So I don't know, maybe the acorns are running out and they're getting mad.
I was going to say, they're aggressive anyway, aren't they? Aren't they pretty aggressive?
Yeah, I don't know what more aggressive would look like for a blue jay. Drawing weapons, like, I don't know.
But. Yeah. Well, I'm gonna head up to my perch in the tower, and I'll be looking out for ospreys today. Oh. I do see them flying by, you know, going to their nesting sites. So if I do see one, how do I report it?
eBird or the Vineyard. There's two different birding groups on Facebook for the Vineyard. Also, if you're one of the, are you a Facebook person?
If not, you can go eBird, right?
Yeah. I know. What's that? Sue Whiting and Matt Pelican are big into the birds.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, tell them.
I can call them.
Yeah.
Yes,
exactly.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for sharing. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Pam writes, I've been seeing a single-eared grebe in West Falmouth as I walk the bike path each morning. The bird has remained in the same area for about 3 weeks. Seems quite far off course from what I've read in Peterson's field guide. Rare sighting? I've got a few photos, but none noteworthy.
It would be rare, but it's almost certainly a horned grebe, which is the common grebe. It's not super easy to tell them apart, especially if you're just a, you know, casual birder. I've seen very seasoned late career birders who mix them up down in Florida. But yeah, horned grebe is pretty common. They're about the same size, pretty similar patterns, subtle differences. But eared grebe does turn up. It's worth looking at photos, sending it to someone who could help you, or putting it on one of the Facebook groups. There's a Falmouth one. There's a Falmouth Wildlife one. There's Cape Cod Birders. But anyway, they're great little birds. They breed further north in big marshes, north and west mainly, and then come here in the winter and they dive for fish. And grebes are just fun. They don't have webbed feet. They have lobed toes. They can do interesting things like submerge straight down like a submarine. Hmm. At least the pied-billed grebe could do that. They're beautiful in breeding plumage, but we might get, you know, if they're still here in May, if you catch some grebes that are still here in May, you'll see them in their breeding plumage where they have fancy tufts and yellows and blues and greens. But a nice little bird. I suspect it's a horned grebe, but again, if you can get those photos somewhere where somebody can tell you one way or the other, we can figure it out.
All right. Tom is calling from Harwich. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I'm sitting here watching two bluebirds going in and out of a birdhouse, and looks like they've committed to this one, but last year it had chickadees in there that had 9 eggs, and I was wondering how long does it take for a bird to develop an egg? I mean, it couldn't be flying around with all 9 eggs in it at one time, could it?
No, they develop fairly quickly leading up to egg laying period. But yeah, they're not carrying them around in the winter. Their bodies are not in the right condition. Their ovaries are not in the right condition. But yeah, that's a lot of eggs.
That seems like a lot. 9 eggs? Is that unusual?
Chickadees have a lot of eggs.
They do. Wow.
No, I don't know what the maximum clutch size is, but they do have a lot. It's, I think, one of the secrets to their success, because I think they have to have a lot of babies because they don't migrate. Mm. You've got to survive the winter, and so you're hedging your bets by investing in lots of babies. That's my guess anyway. But yeah, the bluebirds, I wouldn't put much stock in bluebirds. They're just, you know, they're just sort of like perusing the real estate pages. Like I always say, like adults, right? It's all adults are always kind of like, is that house for sale?
Hey,
we're
house.
Not on the market.
Let's check it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go to the open house. We're not on the market, but let's go. So, and what's happening is the male is probably getting ahead of things, and he's got a lady and he wants to show her some places. He's like, huh? How about this one, huh? And she's like, oh yeah. She goes in and looks around, and you know, the kitchen's kind of dated. I really wanted something turnkey, but it's probably a little early for them to definitively pick that site, but maybe they will. Maybe they'll keep coming back, and maybe they'll realize that it was the best thing out there, and they'll circle back in a few weeks and lay some eggs in there.
Yeah. All right, Tom, thanks. Thanks for the call. Abby writes, my husband and I saw a pair of killdeer on a north-facing beach in Vineyard Haven last week.
A killdeer. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. That's one of the signs of spring I didn't mention. If you know what they sound like, and it's a little tricky because starlings imitate them, but killdeer are birds of open fields, ball field. They're not picky. Ball fields are classic places where they nest, kind of the far edges of ball fields, gravel pits, active construction sites. But airports are kind of the best places to see numbers of them and actually expect to see killdeer. So something like the Chatham Airport or maybe Marson's Mills Airport or wet agricultural fields right now, great place to see killdeer because they are pretty early migrant. Again, short distance migrant. So they're not coming back from South America. And so they can kind of pop back and see what's going on in late February or March. And live to tell the tale. Yeah. So yeah, this is a great time of year to listen for them and look for killdeer. It's a big plover, much bigger than a piping plover. People mix them up. You know, I see the anti-plover people in the comment threads and whatever. Like, I see them at the golf course. They're common. but that's killdeer, and they're much bigger. They're dark brown. They have 2 rings around the neck. But they're fun birds. You know, people's best chance to see that classic distraction display that most shorebirds do. They pretend to have a broken wing. And they sort they're leading you away from their nest.
Get away.
They're leading you away from either eggs or chicks. And they're like, oh, my wing. Oh, yeah, come over here. And then once they get you away from the nest, they fly perfectly fine back to where the babies are. Yeah.
Sue in Centerville writes, she's talking about bluebirds. I have 2 males and 1 female who have been visiting my feeders for several years now. I think they are the same birds. Last year, one of the males was mateless and called for a female all summer.
Mm. Poor guy. I've been there. yeah. I've had summers like that. But that's interesting. But yeah, I don't know how to tell if they're the same ones. It could be.
Could be. You never
Certainly
know,
if
right?
it's just if it's yeah. just been a few years. Yeah. You know, songbirds live maybe 5-6 years, maybe 9. 11 would be a really old songbird.
Yeah.
So yes, it certainly could be.
Let's go back to our place on the Cape. Yeah.
Other
signs of spring, we have salamanders, peepers, wood frogs. I saw somebody posted a beautiful picture about one of those yellow spotted salamanders. It reminded me of my childhood. I lived near a pond and I was like, oh, I haven't seen one since I think I was a kid.
Yeah, I didn't have those. I didn't ever see one, a spotted salamander, which are the classic vernal pool salamander that
beautiful.
Crosses roads in March, first warm rains of March. They come out and they just scurry down into the vernal pools, and it's something you can see at night, bring a flashlight. But I only had the redback salamanders around me in Brockton. I never saw one, but this is when that's happening, a warm rainy night. Be really careful driving, because you're coming out looking for them. Yay, I love the salamander, you're running them over. So you got to be very careful, get a sense. You kind of learn what they look like in the road. They're big. They're not, if your reference for a salamander is a redback salamander, a spotted salamander could eat several redback salamanders and still not be full, to give you, they're much, much bigger.
Yeah.
And so they're dark with those bright yellow spots. It's just fascinating. It's like they're breeding under the ice in some cases.
Crazy.
I mean, it's not like that this winter, but in other winters, they can handle that.
Yeah.
And the males go into the vernal pool and they put down these spermatophores that the females pick up, and you can see this. And if you go with kids, like the Buttonbush Swamp and Salt Pond Visitor Center is a good place, because there's a boardwalk over the vernal pool.
Wow.
So you can look down in with a flashlight and see the all of the magic that happens in vernal pools, the breeding salamanders, the fairy shrimp, which are these, it's a vernal pool obligate species that you can see kind of like moving up and down in the water column. It's beautiful little invertebrates. So I highly recommend that. Wood frogs are calling in some places. If people aren't familiar with them, they're like, what the heck is that? It's like, sounds like a bunch of people all walking in squeaky shoes at once. it's a little bit duck-like. It's hard to describe, but certainly peepers have been going for more than a week now, definitely. And some deafening choruses I've heard of spring peepers already. These are really hardy amphibians that, like, you can hear a peeper. There's not a month of the year that you shouldn't expect to hear a peeper on a warm day.
Mm.
They're just, they don't go completely torpid or hibernating. They will become active again, and they can handle cold. It's all of these things together can get us through this season where you wait, it's still in the 30s in the morning, like, but the animals are giving us hope. They're like, come on, hang in there.
And I remember it was a few years ago, I want to say maybe more than a few. I don't know if you remember this, Mark. I had this weird, something making a weird sound in my backyard, and I recorded it, and you said it was a Fowler frog. What an odd sound they made.
Fowler's toad. Yeah, they're one of my favorites. They look just like, I'd say that a lot. They'd look just like an American toad, which is the default toad in much of the Northeast. But Fowler's toads are a kind of a sandy area specialist. At a certain point, as you drive out on the Cape, you stop getting American toads. And by the time you're on the outer Cape, it's really Fowler's toad is the default toad. So they like sandy places, dunes. They burrow down in. And their call is completely different from an American toad is a trill. You start hearing them sometimes around Easter, depending on when Easter is, American toads will start calling this, like, I don't know. I can't really do
it,
but
it's pretty good. Yeah.
But then the Fowler's toad is completely different. It's like,
I thought it was a bird.
Yeah.
And they're loud for a little frog or toad, right? I mean, they're loud.
Yeah. Toads are frogs, apparently. Yeah. It's all very confusing.
Yes,
all toads are frogs. Not all frogs are toads,
okay,
I guess.
Good to know.
Those things. I like to do those things. My son loves doing those things.
Tell you all these
all frog,
facts.
You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so, and then now we talked about songbirds looking for territory and mates, but we've got owls already breeding, right? Do we have eggs already in the owl nest? What's going on with owls?
I'm sure. I can't. Maybe somebody out there knows of one. Where they are seeing the owls incubating. But yeah, theoretically, great horned owls are definitely on eggs right now. Probably have been for a little bit. Bald eagles are on eggs, definitely. The big birds, where it takes a long time compared to a songbird and a lot of parental investment to get that chick, to get those eggs to hatch and to get that chick up to fledging size and weight and ability. It takes a lot of time. And so they start early. And so they can handle late season snowstorms and that kind of thing. That they'll just sit on the eggs and they are the roof over the eggs and keep the snow off of them, keep them warm. So yes, absolutely. I'm not aware of any nests myself, but they're often not shy. Like great horned owls, certainly as you go down into Florida, they nest everywhere right out in the open. But even here, sometimes too, they'll be right next to Route 6 or 6A or something like that, in places that would surprise you that you might not even notice if you didn't look carefully.
Right. Another thing, we talked about this on the point, I think, last week. It is breeding season for coyotes. So you want to be a little bit careful, keep the dogs on a leash, right? Because they're a little more territorial this time of year, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's just always kind of good practice. Big dogs, as we know, they view as a threat. They're not hunting your big dogs, but and then little dogs are like my dog would be food.
Right.
My neighbor's dogs would be a competitor. They don't view them the same way. They've never bothered my dog yet. I feel like they've had ample opportunity. I keep offering him up, but I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I love my Timmy sort of sometimes. But yeah, just be aware. I mean, they're everywhere always, right? And it's like I say, you're not aware of it, and people see them or you know, someone sees one, they're like, coyote alert. They'll put it out on Facebook. Coyote alert. I saw one. And it's like, okay.
They're there all the time.
It's there every night.
Yep.
It's there every night. You know, whether you're putting out an alert or not, they're around. And so just be aware of that, and that's something you need to keep your dog on a leash and not outside alone at night. That the dog should not be outside
not
in the
yard
alone.
They
can,
sure,
they can jump fences and all that. Coexist. Yeah.
So pretty soon, we will start seeing songbird babies. I'm getting ahead of myself here, but it's always good to mention. Just because a baby bird is on the ground doesn't mean it's in trouble.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it really is. I guess there are baby squirrels already.
I was just going to ask about that.
There's
squirrels, right?
There
are baby squirrels now, right?
Yeah. And, you know, tree work is going on. And so, you know, that's the beginning of the season for the wildlife rehabbers. But yeah, I mean, things like mourning doves will be nesting any second now. And so we're really not far from baby bird season. It's already begun probably to some extent.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. If it's a little early for there to be like a mostly fledged baby bird,
right?
But you know, the classic thing is the robins, because the robins, they're not really independent when they leave the nest. And so you'll see one on the ground somewhere looking kind of helpless and stubby and obviously not fully feathered out, but it's okay. The adults are feeding it, even though it's not in the nest. So it takes a little bit of context to understand what you need to do in the case of a baby bird. If it's like naked, obviously it's not independent and it does need to get into a nest, or maybe that's a case where it goes to the wildlife rehabber.
And but you can
look
pick
for
it
the,
up.
Look
and
for the nest.
You can put it back in the next nest. Yeah,
absolutely. You put it, if you know where the nest is, it's simple. There's no, the mother's not going to reject it. These old wives' tales that we knew when we were kids, like, oh, no, you can manhandle baby birds. I mean, everybody, the researchers study baby birds. You take them out of the nest, you band them, you weigh them, you measure them, you put them back in the nest, and the parents just wait, and then they go right back to feeding it. And so there's no issue with putting the bird back in the nest. So that's the best case scenario is you're like, oh, there's the nest, and you just put it back.
All right. Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. As always, thank you, Mark.
All right. Catch you next time.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.